Hello, listeners. I'm Logan McLean, and this is OJT, On the Job Training. It's a podcast where I, a journalism student, practice my craft by interviewing passionate people about their projects. Carrie McCaffrey is an academic librarian who works at UPEI's Robertson Library. Carrie is a true educator who's dedicated to critical thinking and helping library clients access knowledge. We talk about her background in books, the journey from history buff to librarian, and the value of free information. Carrie McCaffrey, welcome to OJT.
Thanks.
To start a little bit about, you got married this summer.
I did.
Tell me about that.
I somehow managed to get married during COVID. we're very fortunate to live on PEI. That was basically the only reason why we could do it is because we were in the bubble. But, you know, we made it work. And I mean, at first people were like, well, the whole point of getting married is married, not the wedding. And I was just like, you can shut up. I've been planning this for 2 years. And then I got to the point where I was like, yeah, okay. The whole point is marrying, I guess.
Did you have to do anything COVID specific?
Anything COVID? We had to have like a plan, but we didn't have to submit it to anyone.
Okay. What kind of plan? Like an emergency escape plan?
Well, like how we were like doing social distancing and like basically stuff we had already thought about. Like we had to make, we changed our entire food plan and everything was individually wrapped and we had to buy like hand sanitizer, just like stuff we had basically already thought about because we're not like flat out idiots. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think I'll go to a bit of your own background. Did you grow up in PEI?
I did. Yeah.
Did you always have sort of a love of learning and books, or did that, like, you're a librarian now, so kind of walk me through how we got to Carrie the librarian.
I was never one of those people that like knew exactly what they were going to be from like when they were five or seven or like even like third year university. I just kind of I guess I was fortunate enough to just pursue whatever I thought was interesting to me. I thought I was going to go into English. I ended up switching to history, and I was very, very interested in it, and especially like Atlantic history and PEI history. And then as I got closer to like my fourth year trying to figure out like what am I going to do with an arts degree, I was pretty interested in like the archival side of history, like keeping historical documents and stuff like that. So I think that's sort of what led me to getting my MLIS, which is Masters of Library and Information Studies, because it does have like archival parts to that. And then when I got into my master's degree, I was actually like, screw archives, I want to be an academic librarian. I was actually pretty interested in health sciences, being like a health science librarian too. But you know, academic library is, they're awesome. And I guess I just want to be in school forever. I don't know.
Do you find that you, yeah, do you feel like you're still in school working at a university library?
Like, no and yes. I really enjoyed the community of being at UPEI. I really enjoyed it when I was here. So it was nice to like come back to that community in a different way. But I also do feel a little bit like a student because I decided to take a class this semester to learn how to code. So that's interesting because it's been, I think, like 4 or 5 years since I've taken an actual class.
How's that going?
You know what? I don't hate math. I actually quite enjoy it, but I haven't done calculus in like 10 years. Despite the fact that it's computer science, it is within the school of math, stats, and computer science. So there is some math stuff in it that's really terrifying. But the coding part of it, I love.
Is this like all online or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all online.
Does that pose much of an obstacle? But with a coding course, I can see it making sense.
I mean, it's kind of the same obstacle, I guess, as any online course, you know. I can see it from both sides because I do like teach library instruction as well. And like when you're the student, it's nice because you're a little more invisible, but also it's harder to like get that community that you normally have in a university. And then on the instructor side, it's really hard to get feedback because people will talk in the chat, but no one wants to open their mic. The labs, I think, is the only part I wish were in person. Just because, you know, the lab instructor would walk around and answer someone's question and then like would tell everyone about it. And in the labs, you basically just sit like on a Zoom call and wait until someone like has a question and then they talk about it. And so sometimes you're just like connected to a Zoom call working on a lab and nothing happens. Like it's weird. They're doing their best with what they've got, but yeah.
What's the COVID situation at the library? Is it real quiet or?
Oh yeah. There's so many less students. Just because there's less students that have to be in person. It's pretty dead. It feels kind of like summertime where there's just a couple people floating around. There's definitely people using the library still and that need the library, but like you have to basically book a space to come into the library if you like want to sit and do anything. Like we have to retrieve a book if you want a physical book. One of the staff members will go get it. It's very, yeah. And we have shorter hours, which is kind of strange. It's a weird year. And you're like tied between like you want to be there for the students, but you also have to be safe.
Have people been pretty patient with you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, way more patient than we thought.
Yeah.
Just as someone who worked in customer service a lot, like as a teenager and young adult, I was definitely expecting the worst. But I don't think we've had any issues. And we even asked the public to not come in for the first month, and we haven't had any issues with that either. Everyone's been really patient and kind and nice to everyone, which is nice.
So just walking back a little bit here, when you were younger, did you have any sort of, were you someone who went to libraries a lot? Did you have any like school librarians who kind of stood out to you, who, you know, recommended books or that sort of thing? Was it an institution that meant a lot to you? Or is that something that kind of came later?
I mean, I was a big book reader when I was younger, definitely. And my parents would take us to the public library for sure. But not to like program or anything, but they would take us to like just go pick out books. I remember one librarian specifically in junior high, but that's also because she taught us English, I think. But I mean, she was great though.
Yeah. Tell me about her a bit.
I think probably one of the biggest memories is in grade 8, we were able to sign up to take a trip to Washington to see the Holocaust Museum. So we actually had to do some like after school classes with her. We like read some books about it and discussed it and everything. So that was quite interesting, definitely.
What about growing up on PEI? Were your family big readers? Was that at all an influence on you?
My grandmother was a really big reader. My mom reads occasionally, but I guess not really. I mean, they always read to us when we were kids, but they themselves are not big readers, no.
Do you think being read to as a kid made a difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think reading to children is so friggin' important. So important.
Tell me a bit about that. Why is it important?
Oh, God, put me in the spot here. Well,
that's,
you know,
my job.
The librarian in me wants to be like, well, there's multiple studies that say that reading to children does this, this, and this. I don't know it off the top of my head, but I do know there is multiple studies. It's recommended by so many like organizations, like medical ones. And it just, I think it's important for like helping children not only just like learn to read and write, but also to be creative, and also to help them like learn other people's stories, learn about other cultures and stuff like that too.
Were there any books that stood out when you were a kid that you would, any that you might even recommend yourself if kids came in?
I was a big Dr. Seuss fan when I was pretty young. I remember I definitely got trouble a few times for reading like under the covers, like a stack of books beside the bed after bedtime. And I remember doing that a lot with like the the Dr. Seuss books for sure.
Did you ever get, when you were a kid in school, in trouble for like reading in class?
Yeah. Yeah. Like I loved the reading period. That was great. You're like, yes, everyone is shut up and I just get to read for like half an hour or an hour.
I used to get detention a lot in like grade 7 and 8
for,
you know, being a 13-year-old. And that was pretty much my stance on it too.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, an hour to read. You want to punish us, make me stare at the wall or do homework.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you think, kind of on that note, what do you think is the role of a librarian in society or even like on a personal level?
Yeah, I guess just like a brief overview, it kind of depends on what type of a librarian you are.
Right.
Like in your within your job, obviously it can really differ depending on what type of librarian you like, what librarian job you have gotten, because there's so many different specific ones. Like you can be focused on instruction or collections, which is like buying the books and the access to journals and stuff like that. There's so many different types of librarians you can really be, but I guess in a very broad sense, it's about, to me at least, it's about making sure that people are critical about the information they are seeing and educating them on how to do that. I would say that's a very, very important part of being a librarian, for me, especially in this day and age.
How difficult is that in, as you just said, this day and age of fake news and deep fakes and God knows what else?
It's depends on the person on whether or not it's difficult, right? Some people, it just comes to them easily. And I mean, there's so many examples now. And like being able to teach, like it's basically teaching critical thinking, which is almost like, that's like a lifelong thing to learn, is critical thinking. Being able to decide, is this information biased? And people also don't want to take the time to figure out if it's biased or like what source it's coming from, or if they should even like look at the date. Like so many times people on Facebook will share something that's like 3 years old and you're like, come on, this isn't relevant.
Do you find yourself arguing with people online about stuff like that?
Depending on who it is, I will correct them, especially with the masks and everything. I will correct people. And I always try to do it from like an educational standpoint, because I like to think that the people in at least my like small Facebook quote unquote friends list are open-minded and willing to learn. They're not stuck in their ways. But when we're talking about like health, like you don't need to be sharing things about how people can't breathe through masks. All of the studies say that they can. All of them say that the oxygen levels are fine. Like, let's not influence people to not wear masks. So I usually come at it as like an educational way. I'll try to like bring up a couple of, well, I'll research it first. I'd look at something and be like, I don't think this is right. Go research it a little bit. And then kind of like type out a response. And most people will respond back to me and like genuinely ask questions about it, which is nice.
Yeah, like it. I suspect if you're coming from an educational direction and not just screaming at people that they're wrong, and like you said, you actually do your own research, you know, and come armed with that sort of stuff, that definitely helps. I do have a lot of times where I will type out messages or comments and then I'm like, no, that's, you've never won one of these arguments, Logan. Don't bother.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what hill are you going to die on? Or like, you have to figure out who you're talking to. Like, there is some people where I'm just like, you know what? Just keep swiping. There's no reason.
They're just trolling anyway. So with libraries as an institution, there's sometimes, not even libraries, just the kind of the world of paywalls. That seems to be a real issue with access to information. What are your thoughts on that, with it being so difficult to get access to things like, as an example, with the misinformation, Fox News and Breitbart articles are usually free, but stuff from like The Guardian and The New York Times tends to be behind a paywall.
Yeah, I hate that information has turned into like a capitalism thing. Like, it's turned out as a way for people to make money. And it's not just with like in newspapers and popular sources. The amount of money that libraries spend on getting access to subscriptions to journals, books, and sometimes these are things they don't even own. Like, you're paying for a subscription, so you have access to it as long as you're paying this subscription. And it's necessary, it's needed in academia, unfortunately, right now. But, you know, all of these authors that are contributing to these journals when they submit their journal articles, they get recognition, but they don't get paid. Like, the journal itself is the one making the money.
Right.
It's absolutely ridiculous in my mind. I am 100% supportive of open access, which is journals that are free, essentially. Because there's no reason to be making money off of information that could be, like, when you're talking about how science is, that could be life-saving, you know? If for some reason the hospital that a certain doctor is at doesn't have, like, access to this one journal article and they have to make, you know, a decision, that could be life-saving if they had it. It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me. And, that's something that I like to tell students a lot, is that, like, you don't have to pay for this information. Please don't pay for this information. Like, you're already paying way too much for schooling. So, like, we have interlibrary loan, and the majority of libraries have that, where if we don't have something, we have relationships with other libraries, so we can actually get it brought in, or, like, a scan of it for that person, which you can almost always find it from somewhere.
So is that something you see as sort of your role then, as guiding people towards, you know, better access to information if it's available?
Oh, definitely. And just educating. One of the like fundamentals of instruction in being a librarian is educating that information has worth to it, and not just that like monetary worth. It's also like that, you know, if you're putting your information and your data to like a social media or Facebook, like, there's worth to that. You're not getting a free service. You are giving mm-hmm. them information in exchange for that service.
Is that something that you, besides just like the, you know, recommendations here and there to people, is there, do you work towards that in any particular way? Like, helping people have broader access to things behind a paywall?
I don't know if I do that, like, personally. I think it just comes up more often when I'm at work, because I'm up day to day with, like, finding information for people and that kind of stuff. I personally, it's, like, I know what companies do with my data, and I am at the point where, like, I got Facebook when I was 13. I was just giving away all of my data and information. It's all already out there. I'm totally okay with trading my data for free services. But I'm aware of it, though. So I guess I do try to mention it when it comes up in, like, conversations. But I do remember something when everyone was getting rid of Facebook, like, 2 years ago, when that whole issue with, like, I think it was, like, a UK company that had taken a bunch of people's data, but also their friends' data from Facebook. It was, like, that crazy thing that Mark Zuckerberg had to, like, go to the government and talk to them about, which is really funny. If you've never watched it, it's actually hilarious.
It is, yeah.
I was in, like, my MLIS at the time, or I think I had just gotten out of it, so all my friends had, like, a group chat. We were laughing about it. Where was I going with that point? There was a point there. Oh, and I remember someone was like, oh, yeah, I'm not on Facebook anymore because I don't want them to have my information. And I was like, yeah, but you're on Instagram, and Instagram is owned by Facebook. Are you just hopping on a trend? Because, like, they still have your information. You're giving it to them through Instagram.
That's kind of like, I find it funny when people will go on big long rants on Facebook about how they don't want to sign up for the COVID tracking app because it's going to give their information to the government.
Yeah.
Like, who do you think Facebook's selling all your data to?
Yeah. And also, like the government has a lot of information on you already. Like, what else are they going to do? I love the idea of the COVID tracking app. I'm really trying to sell it to people who are like concerned about it because I know how it works. Like they just, it's through Bluetooth, right? And if you're within like 6 feet of someone that has the same app on, then it picks up like a randomized code that is connected to your device. So it's not like picking up your name and your contacts and all this information. Like it's literally just like a randomized code assigned to you. And then after the 14 weeks, if they haven't like put in that they have coded COVID with their like code that they get from the government now, then it just like loses your information anyway.
Yeah.
It's such a smart idea.
Yeah. It's like if you have a license plate, a cell phone, a home address.
Yeah. Like literally they assign us all numbers at birth.
Yeah.
Like what do you think your social insurance number is?
Yep.
It's a way to track you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the arguments I don't bother getting into, though.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just try not to shake hands with those people. And that's where we'll have to leave things for this episode. Carrie will be back soon for part two, where we get into politics and the power of knowledge. Until then, it's time for this week's progress report. For new listeners, this is the segment where I go through some of what I've been learning here at OJT, hosting, but also producing, marketing, and whatever else goes into independent journalism. In one of my college courses last week, we talked about pre-interviews. The idea is that, for broadcast work like radio or TV or a podcast, you don't just talk to the person on air. You ask them basic questions to form an interviewing strategy before ever hitting record. Then, when you sit down behind the mic, you know what to ask and the guest has had something of a chance to think about stories they want to tell. While the best interviews look and feel like a natural conversation, the reality is more structured. That's not to say they're dishonest or manufactured, at least the good ones aren't. There's just a lot that goes into producing a quality broadcast piece. Which brings me to this interview with Carrie. We did not do a pre-interview, and I think it shows. Carrie and I only met, I think, once before this episode. So my questions like, did you grow up on PEI, were true searches for information when they should have been a setup to something deeper. I assumed Carrie was an Islander, but I should have known that. But it's not that I was unprepared, listeners. I just didn't realize what I was doing. With all the past episodes, I knew the guests fairly well. It never occurred to me until this interview with Carrie was underway that I hadn't set it up right. Making things worse, I clipped my mic stand to the table I was resting my notebook on, and I couldn't get physically comfortable without bumping the mic. This isn't an issue with typical reporting where you need four hands and two brains just to stay on your feet. There, it's just part of the fun. But with podcasting, everything is caught on tape, and the tape is all there is. Sounds like shifting in your squeaky chair, or the notepad sticking to your sweaty hand every time you try to write something, those are tough to edit. So I spent most of the interview trying not to move or touch anything, and it really made a mess of my notes and concentration. Now, all that said, I really enjoyed talking to Carrie. These little stumbles just make me look forward to round two. I'm already making a list of should've, could've questions. And that's all for episode 11. You can follow the Robertson Library on Instagram at Robertson Library. Carrie also requested I mention BIPOC Usher as an organization to check out. That stands for Black and Indigenous People of Color United for Strength Home Relationship. They can be consulted for resources and help with anti-racist training. You can follow this podcast on Instagram at OJT_podcast and on Twitter at OJTpodcast. The Facebook page is OJT On the Job Training. You can follow me on Instagram at Logan.McLean.75 and on Twitter at LoganMcLean94. And finally, listeners, please check out my website, OJTpod.ca, for my written stories and photography. Podcast is available there and on all major streaming platforms. Please rate and subscribe and leave a review. Everything helps when getting a podcast off the ground. And if you like this show and want more interesting guests, listener feedback is the best way to help me reach new people and make that happen. This has been OJT, On the Job Training. I'm Logan McLean. Thank you for listening.